Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome back to Amazon Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. It's been a minute. We did a crossover episode with our friends at Apato recently. And so, Chris, you and I have not sat and talked about Mets baseball in some time. So welcome back. And how are you feeling about the Mets on December 2nd, 2020?
Pretty good at the moment. The last time we talked, has it been since just before Cohen was actually approved as the owner?
Oh,
I think it might have been.
Oh my goodness.
Which feels like a year ago, but it was only a few weeks.
Yeah. I'm gonna look this up while we do this now, but I mean it has been a while. I don't know if we talked about that first Cohen presser together or not.
No, I think that was the chat with Apoto was right after that. I don't think we did. If we did, and we're repeating ourselves, sorry everybody, but
yeah, exactly.
I don't think we did. Between that and then, I know we certainly haven't had an episode since Cohen went on SNY and had the interview with Steve Gelbs, where they spliced it up and forced people to watch studio stuff in between the thing that they actually wanted to watch. but you know, Cohen revealing that he owns the ball that Mookie Wilson hit through Bill Buckner's legs, that he bought at auction for an insane amount of money a few years ago, and nobody ever knew it was him until then. We haven't talked since that, and yeah, that was a cool moment, and I think to come from like a. I always, it's been like a decade, a little more than a decade of like the worst of the Wilpons, because from, you know, from when they became sole owners of the team to 2006, 2007, 2008, that wasn't that bad. There were a couple really bad teams in there. And then there were three very good teams that came up short. And I guess the bad ending, I don't know, for some Mets fans might sit a little bit worse, but I do appreciate that the Mets were very good for 3 years in that span and sort of teased being good in 2005. So it's really the like 2010 on era of the Wilpons that has the most sour taste for me. and the fact that they were just so inaccessible in any form to switch over to this owner who seems to be pretty good at this, just talking and being a Mets fan. And I don't know how available he's going to be on an ongoing basis, but just for the first two public appearances, it's been like, oh, okay, this guy can handle himself and speak to fans in a way that I think they like.
Yeah. We last spoke on October 21st, by the way. Holy shit.
Wow.
Yeah, it has been a while. I don't know. You know, we've talked in the past about how, you know, it's you're very rarely going to find a billionaire with a heart of gold. But Cohen's passing the early tests pretty well. I recognize this is a finely crafted media persona. I also realize that we had the Wilpons before this, so the bar is incredibly low for all of this. But, I mean, I can't imagine that there are too many Mets fans out there who, if they had the amount of money that Cohen had, wouldn't want to have the ball that Mookie Wilson hit through Buckner's legs, right? That's just a very, like, that's a very fan move. And I feel like a lot of the stuff he talks about just seems to be that he is, you know, he's a fan. I don't even think he's particularly a smart fan. I don't mean that to insult him, but I mean, like, I don't think he's... I don't think he's trying to play cool about anything. Like, he likes the black jerseys. If he was a hipster, he would never be pro black jerseys. You know what I mean? Like, he just seems like he's very authentic in his fandom. And that's amazing. That's great. I actually didn't watch the Gelbs interview with him. I was getting my updates close enough, you know, via Twitter that I didn't need to necessarily sit and watch the whole thing, because SNY programming just keeps getting worse and worse, and I knew there'd be a fair amount of Andy Martino or the like that I had to sit through, and I just didn't feel like sitting through that. But, you know, Cohen on Twitter has been great as well, just, you know, being very honest with fans and interacting with them. And it's just it's been a nice few weeks of Cohen happiness. However, that happiness has started to be challenged a bit because people seem to be quite upset that he has not yet hired a general manager. There are a lot of reasons for this. Some are saying that Sandy Alderson essentially acting as the head of baseball ops means that he's going to be running the show this year. And so top people don't want to be basically the second in command. They want to be in charge. And so that's why you're not seeing the Theo Epsteins of the world, for instance, interviewing with the Mets. But there are plenty of people who I think probably have enough experience to meet Cohen's demands. You know, Cohen said he doesn't want people learning on his dime. That was one of the first things he said in his presser. But there are probably enough people out there that have some sort of experience that could fit that role, and they're not hiring anybody. To me, that means they're maybe being thorough. Maybe it means they're looking for something specific that isn't out there yet. But, you know, leave it to, again, a Sandy Alderson phrase, Panic City, to really get up in arms about this. Do you think it's a big deal that the Mets don't have a GM yet?
No, I mean, it's not something that had really been keeping me up at night. And obviously it would be ideal if they had a front office in place from the, you know, day the offseason started. But given the reality that they're in, that Cohen completes the purchase of the team, but they just don't decide, the Major League Baseball, that is, doesn't convene the owners to have that vote to make it official until a few days after the season ended, maybe even just 2 or 3 days, but whatever it was, that delay, I think, is significant just because we know you had tapped Alderson for the role of team president and sort of had that as a, you know, something to show where he might take the franchise before everything became official. But I don't know how much you can get access to guys and get them to be comfortable with saying, okay, yeah, I'm going to come work for the new Mets front office before you get to the point that they officially take over and clean house and say, you know, goodbye to Van Wagenen, Omar Minaya, and, you know, a few other folks there in the front office. So, I would prefer that they had more in the front office than they do at the moment, but I care far more about what happens with players, whether they're free agents or on the trade market or guys who were non-tendered, who we'll get to in a little bit. But I don't know. I don't have any like wish list in a year if Theo Epstein became a member of the Mets organization, great. But I don't know. I'm just not in love with anybody on the front office side. So as long as they're capable of operating and the players that they want are not slipping away because it's Alderson and the staff, but not GM and maybe some of those other high-ranking front office positions that you would see, I'm not too concerned about it. I would hope that they'll make a hire sometime in the near future just because that would be – it would be nice to just have it in the books. But, yeah, I don't know. If it's just Alderson this winter with a real budget – and presumably a defined budget, which is something that was lacking. Funds were lacking, but also knowledge of what those funds were was lacking when Alderson was operating under the Wilpons. And just as a quick aside, hopefully there aren't too many more episodes where we mention their names.
That's true.
I mean, it's... Oh, my... Steve Cohen just tweeted, who was the most interesting player non-tendered and why? Crowdsourcing. We pause my train of thought so I can retweet this on the Amazing Avenue account.
You should also tweet at him to listen to our show tomorrow and find out.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
He's online enough.
He is online enough, yes. I take back everything bad I said, Steve, because you're now a listener.
Rich tweeted at him, my wife non-tendered me.
Of course he did.
Sorry, everybody. This is getting derailed by Mets Twitter in a good way.
Yes, yes. I mean, just think about the fun we're having with this right now. This is totally foreign to a Mets fan.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
All right. Anyway, so yeah. Front office, not a big deal. I'm confident in Alderson's ability to especially because I feel like this offseason they're not going to be trading as much as they might in other offseasons. I think you're just going to see a lot more free agent signings, and that, to me, requires far less nuance than trades do. I also think you may see the GM come from the A's, and I wonder if they wanted to put some space between Alderson, except in this position, and then poaching somebody from his former employer. Not just have it look like, you know, as soon as Alderson came over, he's poaching someone from the A's.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that's something that the writers around the team like to mock during Alderson's first time around, at least early on, that there was always, if there's any connection, I guess that it became sort of a thing that I just was tired of when people were complaining about CAA and Van Wagenen. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that they were entirely right or wrong, but I sort of had fatigue from the Alderson era, and you know, see or hear or read these things about, oh, Padres connection, A's connection. And then I think that got played up so much because it was like, oh, he's going to try to run the Mets like the A's, but under that budget, it was a totally different scenario.
Right.
But it was just sort of this lazy comparison, and the real blame was above him in the organization for the way the team was run, not with what he did with the job that he was in at the time. So yeah. But yeah, I'm sure there's somebody who'd be glad to take the role, because as Alderson has alluded to in his public appearances so far, that person could very well be elevated to president of baseball operations in the near future.
Right.
And I think even if that title is effectively Alderson's this year, I don't think he necessarily signed up for this phase of his Mets career to be that hands-on.
I also wonder, and I know I bring him up all the time because of our hometown connection, but I wonder if John Ricco is going to eventually be the one who gets this job.
Right. Yeah, I'm curious after they shifted him over. I know right now they're saying he's staying in the role that he was moved to, or one that's sort of that hybrid role that Alderson was brought in for, to oversee business and baseball operations of the team. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm curious to see how that plays out.
I know that when he was working for Major League Baseball, he being Ricco, that he did a lot with sort of the with the business side of baseball. So maybe he doesn't want to be GM.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's enough about the front office right now, because we don't know too much about there yet. What we do know is that the Mets tendered Steven Matz a contract, which was something that we were not sure about even just an hour and a half ago. You know, Matz was a train wreck last year. I mean, absolutely one of the worst pitchers in baseball by a lot of metrics. And certainly if you just watched him, he looked off. He did not look like the Matz that we had been promised. And, you know, Matz's career has been a lot of starts and stops. He's never really had a sustained level of success after his rookie year. There have been good starts and bad starts. There's been good stretches followed by terrible stretches, you know, and he's somebody who cannot seemingly shake off a bad appearance. You know, when he's in the middle of it, you can see him, his body language changes. He's screaming, his shoulders sloop, you know, he's just a shell of who, as soon as he starts to lose control, he just becomes a shell of who he is able to be. And I think I would not have been surprised if the Mets decided, you know what, there's probably a lot of people out there who have a fair amount of talent, either similar to or perhaps above what Matz has on the free agent market, and now on the non-tender market, which we'll talk about in just a minute, which is, I guess, also the free agent market. Dumbass, but you know what I mean. And so I don't think any of us would have been shocked if he was not tendered a contract, but he was, and it's, you know, it's modest. It's 5.1 or 5.2 million, depending on the source that you're getting that from. And, you know, if Matz can be a number five starter for $5 million, that's a good deal. If Matz looks like he does last year, I think that's a low enough salary that you can cut bait without even blinking an eye. You know, if two starts in, he's just lost, cut him. You know, you can do that now that the Wilpons are not pitching pennies, and now that I think this is probably, everyone probably understands this is Matz's last chance at success. Do you kind of see it the same way?
Yeah, and honestly, I was kind of hoping he would be non-tendered, not because I care. Yeah, Steve Cohen's money doesn't affect me at all, other than potentially bringing happiness through the form of the Mets. But if they, if they retain him going into the season and they end up in that spot that they just say, you know what, this didn't work, you know, we're going to DFA him, I don't care about those $5 million. The only thing is, it's just a little concerning that it could get tempting to see him as a member of the rotation, which in 2018 and 19 he was, and I mean, he was frustrating in those seasons too. He was just a lot better. In this very short season, he was terrible and frustrating, which is a bad combination. But I know when you look at what he's done over the last 3 years, it's not that hard to look and say, hey, his velocity didn't fall off a cliff. He was solid, if a little less than ideal, but still solid in those two full seasons that preceded this one. It might not be that hard to talk yourself into him being in the starting rotation, but it just can't be part of plan A as the Mets go into 2021. And I hope that was clear. Matz didn't have the ability to say, I want something guaranteed or I'm out. He doesn't have that option to leave. The Mets retain control over him, whether he likes it or not. But I do hope that there is some understanding that, hey, look, we know what you've done in the past, and we're going to get into spring training, whatever that looks like. And you're going to be in the mix, but we can't guarantee anything going into the start of the season, because I don't know what Steven Matz is like when it comes to approaching his baseball career and he's not on the mound. So what we see while he's out there, I don't know if that's the same person who, you know, approaches his career that way when he's not in the mode of actively competing. But if there's any similarity between the two, and we know he had made comments that he wasn't crazy about any kind of bullpen role, I hope it's clear and it's not a source of conflict or drama that, hey, look, we're going to see what things look like, see how everything shakes out. And if it looks like we're not going to include you in the rotation, we'll cut you in spring training and you'll have an opportunity to go elsewhere. I hope it's that. And I hope it's not a month from now, we're talking about, okay, DeGrom, Stroman, eventually at some point next year, Syndergaard. Sure, that's a very exciting 1-2 and probable 3. If Syndergaard comes back on a normal timeline from Tommy John, but I wouldn't want it to be Mats Peterson and just fill in the gap. You know, the Mets absolutely still need, to me, at least 2 starting pitchers. And did I say the Mets or the Mets? I don't know what I said, but yeah. So yeah, not thrilled about it, but I can get on board with the rational, hey, look, they don't have a lot of starting pitching depth. You could do worse than hoping Steven Matz is not a 9-something ERA guy as your 5th starter. But I hope that going into spring training, he's at least 6th on any logical depth chart. And you know, that he'd have to really show something impressive to crack the rotation or even crack the bullpen to start the season. I don't know. The logical part of me is like, don't read too much into 2020 stats, but man, he just looked completely bad.
Oh, I mean, beyond bad. Just, you know, man, I mean, just, you know, he looked like he was lost 100% of the time.
Just, yeah,
it was tough. It was tough. But you know what? It's always sad to see a guy you had a lot of hope for as a prospect flame out. And if there's anything left in Mats's tank, I would love to see him show that to the Mets. You know, so I'm rooting for him. You and I also, we should mention, met Mats at his charity event last year, and he was quite nice to us.
Yeah,
so
he
seems like a good guy, you know. And you want to root for those guys. So I hope that he can put it together, but I also hope that there's some prudence in the situations he's put into, and some swiftness to dealing with the issue. You know. At various points in the process, whether that's conversations they have with him now or conversations they're going to have with him, you know, when the season starts. So before we move on to the big free agent signing, you know, there are a number of people who are non-tendered today. There are a number of people who the Mets did offer contracts to. We should mention that Robert Gazelman was a name that was mentioned as possibly being non-tendered. Well, he was offered a contract, as was Guillermo Heredia, as was newly acquired Jacob Barnes. And the rest of the folks that were offered contracts are the folks on the 40-man you would expect to be offered contracts. But the Mets did non-tender 4 players. They non-tendered Paul Sewald, Chasen Shreve, Ariel Jurado, and Nick Tropiano. Now, I don't want to read too much into this. I wouldn't be surprised if a guy like Sewald or Shreve wound up back on the team on a minor league deal. Those type of things do happen, but I don't know exactly. I don't think this is the year the Mets hopefully this isn't the year the Mets go fishing for contracts that for players that way. They have more money to spend. They don't necessarily need to go out and bring back a Paul Sewald, right? Do any of those names surprise you or bug you or, you know, anything like that?
Well, I guess Shreve, I wouldn't say it bugs me. I'm fine with it. But it is interesting that somebody like Heredia, an outfielder who, I don't know, I can't imagine he's going to, I hope anyway, that he's not going to be the guy who factors in as your fourth or fifth outfielder on an opening day roster. So it's just, it's a little odd that he was retained and Shreve wasn't, but I'm also totally fine with freeing up some roster spots and seeing what you can do. Shreve didn't have a long track record of being great. He's had some major league success for sure, but I don't know. Not losing any sleep over it. Fine with freeing up the roster spot. If it turns out that he's the best fit to come back based on what else they do in the bullpen, you know, hey, great. But if not, I don't know. I'm happy to have seen him pitch reasonably well for a very short season. And you know, you can move on. But the other names, Sewald, I had grown a little, sick of watching. So that one I'm fine with. And then Tropiano, I don't really know anything about him. So yeah, all that stuff pales in comparison to Matt's. And with Gazelman, it's pretty much the same thing as Matt's, and as people have pointed out, Gazelman has an option remaining, so he definitely isn't guaranteed anything in terms of major league playing time. And I get it; he's been a capable major league pitcher, although his best work really came in that rookie season when he and Seth Lugo kind of burst onto the scene at the same time out of nowhere and kept the Mets afloat as they got into that wild card game in 2016. But nothing to be angry about, that's for sure. And hopefully the Mets are viewing the guys they retain the same way that we are.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that there has to be a little bit of a hoarding mentality right now with players, because while it sounds really great, there's all these free agents and non-tenders out there, the Mets have to operate under the idea that they're not going to get everyone they want to get. And so if you're holding on to Gazelman for a little bit of money and then you get the players you want, cutting them later is not a huge deal. You know, I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think like you were saying with Mats also and with Gazelman, we just have to be realistic about what they can be. And if they're not, there has to be a quick trigger. There has to be a quick release here. Just, nope, sorry, not working out. Here we go.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then we've been looking at this list of non-tenders, and, you know, one of the names that was on our list has now been taken off the list as they were traded at the last minute. And, you know, that's the nature of the beast here. But we have identified, is it five players? I think we have one, two, three. Yeah, five players that we would be interested in seeing the Mets go after. So, Chris, why don't you pick one and talk about him, then I'll pick the next guy, and vice versa.
Sure. So I'll start with I'll stay on brand with the having a close friend and relative who's a Twins fan. So I'll start with Eddie Rosario, who he's been pretty good. You know, in talking about what he looks like for somebody who watches the Twins on a regular basis, I think the defensive struggles that you see in 2019, for instance, he hit 32 home runs, hit .276, .300, which that's not a great on-base percentage, obviously, but slugged .500. Honestly, for his full seasons over the last 4 years, it was his least good overall performance as a hitter. But that combined with his defense, he's at 1.2 WAR on Fangraphs. The year before he was 3.5. The year before that he was 2.6, mainly because he had better overall offensive lines in those seasons. So I'm not saying he's a perfect fit. The Mets, you know, he's not a center fielder. He's a left-handed hitter, which Brandon Nimmo and Michael Conforto are. So, you know, he's not an ideal platoon partner. Not that I think either of those players should necessarily be platooned, but if that was something that you were looking to exploit, depending on who the Mets were facing that day. But I'm sort of the mind that there's no such thing as having too many good baseball players. And, you know, he is definitely better than some of the guys who are on the bench right now. So I don't think he's a likely guy to end up in Queens. I don't know if he's even necessarily my top choice for anybody who's in this position, but I think he is a good player, and it can't hurt to have more of them. So I'm intrigued by Eddie Rosario.
Okay. The first person I'm going to talk about is somebody who I actually don't want the Mets to necessarily go out, but it's a name that jumped out at me because it's not often that you see a player start 4 opening days for their team and then get non-tenured. And I don't mean start like at second base. I mean start as the pitcher. And Jose Urania started 4 consecutive opening days for the Marlins, and he was non-tendered. Now, he is a very flawed player, and you know his best season was back in 2018 when he put up a 1.7 WAR according to Fangraphs, which is not lighting the world on fire, but for a back of the rotation starter, that's not all that terrible. Since then, you know, he did not pitch as much in 2019, and then 2020 is the weird abnormality that 2020 was. And you know, the Marlins feel there's nothing left in the tank, and so they cut bait on him. And that leads me to believe there probably isn't all that much left, because you know, the team that drafts you, brings you up, the team you've started 4 opening days for, you would think if anybody were gonna see value in you, it would probably be that team that has a lot of investment in you, and they don't see anything left in his tank, and so they're not interested in bringing him back. But I just think when you have the pedigree that Urania had, if he's going to be had for a minor league contract and an invitation to spring training, I don't see why you don't go after him. And honestly, I don't know if Urania could get anything more than that right now. I don't think he has a guaranteed major league contract in his offseason future. Do you?
Yeah, probably not. Not coming off the way he's not pitched all that much over the last 2 seasons, and pitched relatively ineffectively when he did. And I think that could be the case for a lot of these guys.
Yeah.
And you know, regardless of the fact that I don't think that's necessarily a good thing for the sport, if it is the case, the Mets certainly can present an opportunity to players who might be in that position, which is, hey, look, there's no guarantee that Syndergaard comes back. Hopefully we're not treating Steven Matz like he's the lock for the rotation. David Peterson had a very respectable rookie year in this strange year and baseball season that the year we're still experiencing, but the baseball season's over. But Peterson shouldn't be guaranteed anything either. You know, you're not competing with DeGrom and Stroman for a rotation spot, but I do think there's some appeal to getting an opportunity to make a rotation or even the bullpen, and then be an option to join the rotation when that need arises. I think there's some appeal to that, and I don't know. I think Mets fans have been so conditioned to expect the team to be the worst version of what it could be. But I do think there's a legitimately good core in place, and that combination, along with Steve Cohen's money, it might seem like an appealing place to play. So, yeah, I hope it plays out that way. I hope the Mets go into spring training and have lots of options. And yeah, he's like you said, he's not somebody that you'd sign to say, hey, look, he's our number three starter, but he's somebody who very reasonably could be better than David Peterson in 2021. And that's not an insult to Peterson at all. It's just absolutely possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Who is your next highlighted player?
I guess, not that there's a lot of choices on our short list here, but Archie Bradley stands out.
First of all, good baseball name.
Yeah, very, very, very good. But he's been good. He's 28. He won't be 29 until next August. He had a very good year in this short season. He really broke out when the Diamondbacks made him a reliever. And similar to Trevor May, who we'll talk about a little bit more in a few minutes, once he made that switch, he was really good. 2017 was definitely his best performance, but considering he pitched in Arizona, the fact that he went from a 1.73 ERA in 2017 to 3.64 and 3.52 over the two seasons that followed, that's not a terrible thing. It's not, you know, it's not the easiest park to pitch in when that's your home ballpark and you're obviously spending the plurality of your innings in that ballpark. And then he had a nice season this year, albeit in 18 and a third innings. So, yeah, that to me is somebody who I think is capable of being almost as good as Trevor May. Somebody who can really be a middle inning, a higher leverage middle inning to potential setup or closer type of relief pitcher if that need arises. You know, if Edwin Diaz is either ineffective again or if he or anybody else is on the injured list, you know, even for a short while. Bradley has that kind of experience and that kind of track record. So given his age and what he's done, it's kind of wild to me that that's not somebody who the Reds would at least hold on to and try to trade. But we saw the Indians put Brad Hand on waivers and he went unclaimed when he would have been just due 1 year and $10 million. So, you know, if the Mets were to go get Bradley and Hand, and then we'll talk about May, that's a hell of a lot better of a bullpen than they've had in a long time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'll talk about David Dahl next. So, you know, he's an outfielder who plays all three positions. You know, the Mets would probably be looking at him primarily as a center fielder, if only because they have so many corner outfielders right now. And Dahl is a decent but not great outfielder in terms of his fielding. He's also, you know, a decent but not great hitter. You know, if you look at his zips projection for next season, you're looking at a 278, 334, 516 slash line, 19 home runs, a 7.5% walk rate, a 27% strikeout rate. You know, and this is the projection, obviously, but that's not significantly better than Dom Smith, than Michael Conforto, than Brandon Nimmo, then, you know, Jeff McNeil. You know, there are parts of that that are appealing, you know, but he's, I don't think the Mets necessarily need this kind of an outfielder. I think if they're going to go out and get an outfielder, you either go out and get somebody who is a defensive specialist in center field or somebody who is so offensively strong that you don't care about the sort of middling defense out there. Are you higher on Dahl than I am?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if it's the fact that I think I believe I caught him in a minor league game or two back when he was still in, you know, coming up through the Eastern League in Double A. He certainly hasn't torn it up in any of his major league seasons, but somebody who has that sort of background, still just 26, you know, he's not somebody who should take the place of another player on the Mets roster. And it's kind of nice that players like Conforto and Nimmo and Alonso and McNeil, while they came into the league at different ages, none of them are old by any means. So I would just say that if they brought him in, there's a chance that he really turns a corner in a way that some other guys that are out there, I don't see that as a possibility quite as much. But he's not somebody who I would bring in and say, oh, he should play over Nimmo, Conforto, and maybe some of the other guys too who have been in that outfield mix playing out of position. So, yeah. But still, so somebody whose name who came up that it was just like, oh, okay, that's not something that anybody would have predicted 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's definitely an interesting person. It's an interesting name on this list, and it's a name that sort of makes you take notice. And also, you know, like you said before about, I think it was about Archie Bradley, just like, you know, it's never bad to have too many good baseball players on your team. And so if, you know, if he forces you to switch things up a little bit, then I think that may not be the worst thing in the world. If it gives some guys some time off, or it allows you then to trade either him or somebody else, you know, there are lots of, there are lots of options. Just because you sign a guy doesn't mean he's going to be starting in the outfield for you. So, yeah, let's move on to your last guy, Chris, which is our last guy we're going to talk about.
Yeah. So Adam Duvall was not tendered by the Braves. He excelled for them in the last 2 years in a limited role after playing for the Giants for a brief stint, and then the Reds for several years, and then the Reds traded him to the Braves during the 2018 season. You know, this is a guy who I remember more as a Red, even though he's probably played just as much against the Mets in the last 2 years as he did with the Reds over the course of 3.5 seasons. But it's kind of funny that, you know, he hit 33 home runs in 2016, and that's good. You know, similar to who was the first player we talked about? Eddie Rosario. Yep. It's similar to that kind of high power, lower on base percentage kind of offensive season. But that's not the thing that's exciting. It's that in the limited role that he had with the Braves over the last 2 years, he was significantly better than league average as a hitter overall. I can't really speak too much to his defense, but it's some serious pop. And importantly, he's a right-handed bat. And that is something that doesn't concern me too much with the Mets, but they are definitely lefty heavy. And especially in the outfield. So as you play out next season, and this is a point that I think applies maybe a little more to the pitching side of things, but a normal baseball season is long. And I just don't know that there's any real way to train for it other than by having one. So I think next season is going to be a little unique in the sense that, let's just assume they play 162 games, regardless of where the pandemic is and whether or not there are fans in the stands in partial or full capacity. Let's just assume they play 162 games of baseball. I think a lot of these guys are going to need a few more days off than we've become accustomed to. So somebody like Duvall is appealing in that you're not necessarily saying to Brandon Nimmo or Michael Conforto that you're never going to start a game against a left-handed starter. But if you can be strategic, and I know it's hard to take things that you plan for in the offseason and then implement them sometimes when real baseball life comes into play and somebody's nursing a minor injury and all the variables that can go into those decisions. But in an ideal world, I like the idea that if you're going to give guys some rest and try to pace yourselves as you go through what is going to be a different kind of strange season coming off of this one, I think a right-handed bat has some appeal. And my guess is that, like a lot of these guys, he's not going to make nothing, but is not somebody who's going to require a major commitment to bring on board.
The other thing that I thought we'd have an answer to by right now, but we don't, is we don't know if the Mets are going to have a DH this year.
Right. And it's ridiculous that that hasn't been resolved.
Yes. Yes, it is. And I would think that if there is a DH, then a player like Duvall becomes a lot more interesting, not necessarily because he's going to be DH'd, but if you're using the DH as kind of a rotating spot and a lefty is on the mound that day, well, then maybe it just gives you another position to be flexible at. I don't need to tell our listeners how the DH works. It will certainly make adding a bat like Duvall to make a little bit more sense to me. We were talking before we started recording, I think we all thought this was going to be, I think you called it a bloodbath or a slaughterhouse or something like that, of players just being cut left and right. You know, I think the biggest name out there is Kyle Schwarber that's been cut. I would say he's probably the biggest name, even though he has not lived up to his past pedigree as of late. There are a lot of interesting names here, and I think that combined with the top free agents that are out there that the Mets appear to be in on, it seems like they are in a good position to improve their team mightily and in a lot of ways. So let's hope they do that. And on that note, the Mets did improve their team, I would say mightily, earlier this week when they signed Trevor May. Now, Chris, you were writing or are still writing a piece about the Mets bullpen with May in it, so we're not going to totally spoil that piece, but where do you see May fitting into this team?
I want to believe that Edwin Diaz is really good and that 2019 was just a weird blip, and that what he did in 2018, 2017, 2016, and 2020 in a short season, I want to believe that's the real guy who he is. And the fact that the strikeout rate never went away and it was just a weird home run problem, I'm somewhat optimistic that could be the case. So if Diaz is your marquee relief pitcher, I think May and Lugo are going to kind of slot in as equally good and reliable pitchers. And we'll see how they handle the rest of the bullpen over the next few weeks and a couple of months even. But that takes some pressure off. If Jeurys Familia is okay or bad, hopefully they can not have to use him in big spots. And if he's really bad, consider parting ways with just next year left on his contract. Dylan Betances did not look good this year at all. It takes pressure off those kinds of guys. And in an ideal world, I mean, even if we're just talking about the guys we talked about from the non-tender world of baseball players, you can have Familia and Betances as potential bonuses that go into the season almost definitely making the opening day bullpen if they're healthy, but fifth, sixth, seventh, or eighth guys on the bullpen depth chart. And then if it turns out they're dominant or just good, they can move up. I like the luxury of that a lot, and it'll become a luxury if they continue to pursue pitchers who are good. But starting pitchers who fail at that at the major league level but then become good relievers have always sort of fascinated me. And May is one of them. And I think when you...
As is Seth Lugo, by the way.
Yeah. And for the record, I totally respect that he would prefer to be a starting pitcher. But I don't know. At a certain point, like, I don't think Malcolm Young ever complained about being the rhythm guitarist of AC/DC. Like, you are part of something incredible, and you're really good at that, and there's somebody else here who's better at the other thing. I have no idea what the dynamic was when AC/DC was young, and forming the band. But, you know, in that case, his little brother was tearing it up, and he was just on point on rhythm guitar. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, if you're awesome at that, embrace it. You know, far be it from me to say that you shouldn't want the job that could be more lucrative in the baseball world, but I don't know. Just own that you are awesome as a reliever.
I wish I was awesome as a reliever.
Yeah. I was not awesome as a reliever in high school. I would love to be awesome as a reliever in Major League Baseball. But yeah, I think when you talk to or read quotes from people who watched May or watched the AL Central on a regular basis, this is somebody who's very good. I think, sure, there's potential there that he could be even better than what he's been over the last three seasons with the Twins. But even if he's just that, that's fine.
Yeah, you know, and while it's obviously more important what he does on the field, he seems like a really good guy off the field. He's a big Twitch streamer. He seems to have a good sense of humor. He has a strong Twitter presence. Those things are nowhere near as important as what he's like as a ball player. But it's always nice to find a guy like a Jerry Blevins, for instance. And it seems like the bullpen also breeds these kind of guys. The guys that are a little bit strange and a little bit fun. And those are the guys I really enjoy rooting for. So from just like a personal level, you know, I would much rather root for, you know, Trevor May than root for Jay Reese Familia because of his past domestic violence accusation. So, you know, I am all for a geeky Twitter user because I am a geeky Twitter user, and I am happy to root for Trevor May. So yeah, I think it's a fun signing. I think we should also mention the Mets picked up, we mentioned it briefly before, Jacob Barnes off of waivers. And again, like 2020 is a weird blip. Look at his 2018, which he split between two teams, the Brewers and the Angels, I believe. You know, in 2018, he didn't pitch. I'm sorry, 2019. I'm getting all my years mixed up here. You know, he had a not great strikeout and walk rate. You know, he was an okay reliever. He was a journeyman, decent reliever. But again, this just seems like a move that is in case of emergency, you know, break out Barnes, or you saw something in him that you liked and maybe he can repeat that and be the sixth or seventh guy on the depth chart out of the bullpen. I don't think it's a big move. I just feel like we should mention that the Mets did pull him off waivers and signed him to a contract today. So, the Mets bullpen is going to be really interesting because I think last year we all saw a path for the Mets bullpen to be really good, and that path just never materialized once the season actually started.
Yeah. And yeah, Barnes does have that three-season stretch with the Brewers that was pretty solid. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly betting on it happening again, but, you know, that's That's okay. If he's occupying a roster spot that somebody else should clearly take, then we'll complain about that when we get there. But I think overall Mets fans have been very happy this offseason. But I would definitely advise that we continue to just judge things as they happen and then see how they actually play out. And so far, there's no reason not to be optimistic, which is nice.
I also can't believe that next week we'll be talking about the winter meetings.
Yeah.
Like, that's happening next week. You know, it's, I can't believe we are there already.
Yeah, no, me neither.
And so I guess we'll do a show at the end of the winter meetings next week.
Yeah, that would make sense. I don't think they'll be particularly like blockbuster active, you know. Like, what happens? I'm sure that the big reporters will still all have rumors and scoops and all that, but it's just funny that it's not happening in some hotel in like somewhere out west. And it'll just be like, does John Heyman or Ken Rosenthal get invited to a random Zoom? As people are talking, like, you can't run into somebody on the internet when they're having private conversations on the internet.
Right. Yeah. There's always that overheard in the lobby stuff. So,
right.
Yeah.
It would be funny if they were like forced to be listen only participants in video meetings.
Overheard in the Zoom waiting room.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's wild. It still doesn't feel right that it's dark at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, I know.
You know, the way this year has shifted time on all of us, and baseball in particular, I think plays into that rhythm for those of us who were so into it, that a month into the baseball season, it was starting to get dark early, and then it ended and we're already at this. And overall, it hasn't really been cold in the area. You know, some cold days or nights here or there, but to talk about winter meetings right now does not feel normal. And even talking about spring training feels weird, since that was the last normal thing you and I did.
That's true, yeah.
And yeah, presumably we will not be doing, because I doubt that either one of us will be vaccinated, and it may not even be safe, even if we were, to partake in that as soon as February or March of next year.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a real shame. I feel like last year was the first year, like, we talked about this on the pod, but like, I have multiple family members who are within the Port St. Lucie area. And last year I went down on credentials, and my kids are now old enough where I feel a little bit less guilty getting away for a couple of days. And so I felt like, all right, this is the first of many years in a row of spring training, and nope. So,
yeah.
Oh, well. Do you have a music pick for us, Chris?
I do. And it'll be very surprising to longtime listeners of the show. King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard put out a new record, and I am recommending it. It's called KG, and technically it's KG Experimentations with Microtonal Tuning Volume 2. That would be the full, complete title. But essentially it's King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, KG. That's what it's on the front of the record in a large font. So in their prolific output over the last few years, they had done a record called Flying Microtonal Banana, where they each had a small budget to either obtain or build or whatever, a microtonal instrument. And if you're not familiar with that, it's basically, you know, out of Asian music, you have a guitar. It has extra little frets that might not be uniform at every point of the fretboard. So you have these in-between microtonal notes and you know, it sounds different than your standard instrument. So they had done this thing where they kind of challenged themselves to do that stuff to get those instruments in place, write songs and make a record based on that. So this is the second record in that style. And it's like, it's incredibly all over the place, but in a cohesive way. So it's a good listen. There's a couple songs on it that I really love. So far I enjoy it start to finish. And, yeah, I love the flexibility that they have. And, I don't know. Pretty much if you see they have a record coming out, it's probably going to be my music pick on this show, but that's not a bad thing. And as a nice little bonus, they put out a live record from 2016, which was not the show that I first saw them at, but was part of the same, was in the same year as the first time I saw them. So this one came out on the same day, live in San Francisco, but pretty similar to, you know, the experience that I had. So yeah, that was good. And on top of putting out those two records, Stu of King Gizzard, who's the front man and sort of the musical genius, and mastermind and lead guitarist, lead vocalist, all that stuff of the band, had his first kid within the same 24-hour span that those two records were released, which is quite the end of a week.
Wow.
Yeah. And how about you? What's your music pick this week?
So this is inspired by a conversation that you and I had on Slack the other day, which was about some upcoming live stream concerts that were happening. And I mentioned that Primus was doing a live stream concert. And I started thinking about the last time I saw Primus live, and I saw them on the Antipop tour, which is their last tour before their long hiatus in the late 90s. But the first time I saw them was in 97 on the Brown Album tour. And for the Brown Album, they replaced their drummer, Tim Herb Alexander, with Brian Brain Mantia. And they did two albums with Brain. And I really don't like Antipop at all. It's a pretty terrible album. And I like almost everything Les Claypool's ever done. So for me to say that's a terrible album, that's a pretty terrible album. But the one before it, the Brown Album, it sounds like it was recorded in a barn. It's really sort of airy and sort of muffled in places. And it just sounds very analog and very, very like early to mid 70s. Kind of drum sounds on it. I really like the way the drum sounds on it. And it's also the Primus album that I'm a bass player, but I'm not Les Claypool as a bass player. But the only Primus song I regularly play on the bass is called Kalamazoo, which is from the Brown album. And so that's my pick for this week. I think it's probably not regarded in the top tier of Primus records. And I don't know if I would even put it in the top tier, but I think it's something that bands, I think, used to do more and maybe should do more of, which is sometimes you just want to make an album that is kind of a cohesive statement, but isn't necessarily a career changing statement. Like I don't think during this time they were like, this is the new sound of Primus. Listen to us evolve here. They were like, no, we wanted to do this record that kind of was a little bit less tight than the last couple. It was a little bit looser, a little bit rawer. And I think it really works for that. There's a song, Over the Falls, that I really adore. It's an acoustic Primus song, which is a rare thing. Duchess and the Proverbial Mindspread, the aforementioned Kalamazoo, Arnie, the final song. There's some really, really great songs on it. And I go through phases with Primus. I was a Primus, I was in a fucking Primus cover band when I was in high school. I was a big time Primus guy then, and I don't return to them all the time, but when I do, I fall into these like 6 week wormholes where all I listen to are Primus and Frog Brigade records. And so I'm excited for this upcoming live stream, and to prepare for it, I'm listening to an album they probably won't play a single thing from because Brain is no longer in the band and Herb is back, and so they probably won't play any of these songs, but that's okay. I'll still enjoy listening to the Brown album.
I'm going to give a quick bonus recommendation because there's a Les Claypool connection. And I am looking forward to that Primus live stream show as well. And thank you for giving me the heads up on it.
No problem, man.
But Les Claypool made a quick cameo appearance last night. The Museum of Popular Culture in Seattle, MOPOP, honored Alice in Chains with an award. They honor a different, I think it's always a band or musician each year. But they honored them and put together this, I guess usually it's a private in-person event and it's a big fundraiser for them. But given the reality of 2020, they did a streaming show and a lot of bands recorded covers of Alice in Chains songs from wherever worked for them. Metallica did one where they were all in their own homes and appearing on like a Zoom grid. Some bands got together in person on their own, you know, and did songs that way. But there's a lot of really cool stuff in it. And I didn't realize it was going to be put on YouTube. So it is there. So if you just look at MOPOP Alice in Chains, it'll probably be the first thing that comes up. And there were a couple of performances by the current band, which were very good. And on top of that, a lot of either pop-ins by people like Les Claypool who were giving congratulations, or really a bunch of covers, that a lot of which were really well done. And the highlight for me among the covers was Fishbone playing Them Bones, because one, I appreciate a good pun, and two, they killed it. They were so good. So that was awesome. Chris Cornell's daughter played a piano cover of one of the songs that was on the first record when Alice in Chains reformed and made a new album. The last song was a ballad that on the record, the piano was played by Elton John and Jerry Cantrell. It was really a sort of a love song to his lost friend, Layne Staley, to close that record out, which is a heavy song. And hearing Chris Cornell's daughter sing it and sing it beautifully, with the tragic way that his life ended, and knowing that the song is about somebody whose life also came to a tragic end from that same music scene, it was pretty powerful. So it was that it's a bonus recommendation. It's not an album, but there's some cool covers in there, wide variety of performers who contributed to it, and I think it was just cool to hear those songs through different voices and instruments and formats, and just sort of realize how great a lot of the songwriting that band has done has been, you know, over the decades they've existed. So, yeah, Les Claypool brought me on that tangent, but.
That's all right. That was a fun tangent. I meant to check it out last night, and I didn't get a chance to, so that's definitely a good thing to check out in the next couple of days.
Yeah.
So, well, folks, thanks for listening. We appreciate it. Like I said, we'll return next week with the winter meeting special at some point. I'm sure if the Mets go out and sign Real Muto or something, we'll put together some sort of Mason Avenue podcast in the moment. But if not, you'll hear from us at the end of the week. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com for all sorts of Mets news and analysis. And we had made the predictions this week that it would be good for the Mets to maybe part ways with Mats and Gesellman. So we're not always right, but that's okay. you know, we're trying our best here. And we hope you follow us on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook at Amazing Avenue. You can check out this show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get podcasts, you can find us. I'm on Twitter at Brian Needs a Nap. He's on Twitter at Chris McShane. And until next time, let's go Mets.